It's 1923, and Hollywood, like the rest of the country, is thriving. Americans are roaring through the 20s, making lots of money, drinking bootleg booze, dancing the Charleston, and packing themselves into movie theaters to see the latest picture shows. Demand for new films is so great, the studios can't crank them out fast enough. An undeveloped orange grove at the turn of the century, Hollywood is now the prime locale for the hot new industry of motion pictures. Houses are being speed-built to accommodate the explosion of studio personnel needed to help meet the public's insatiable demand for movies. At the height of this construction frenzy, a couple of opportunistic real estate developers hang a sign near the top of the hills surrounding the valley to advertise their new housing development. It has 50-foot-high white letters that spell out Hollywood Land. It is meant to stay there only for 1 year, or until all the units are sold, whichever comes first. But it never comes down. Shortened to Hollywood in 1949, it becomes a hovering symbol of the industry of dreams, and to this day watches over Tinseltown like the giant statue of Jesus over Rio de Janeiro. With revelry running rampant, Hollywood has come under increasing scrutiny by the federal government, which is concerned about its excessive displays of cultural decadence. In response, on December 4th, Cecil B. DeMille, one of the industry founders, premieres his spectacular silent epic, The Ten Commandments, at, appropriately enough, Grauman's Egyptian Theater on Hollywood Boulevard. It is immediately recognized as a moral testament to both ancient times and the present. Shot in rare two-strip Technicolor, and with its breathtaking sequence of the parting of the Red Sea, the film receives rave reviews and packs every theater it plays. Even the government approves. 2 months earlier, 2,000 miles east and light years away from the manufactured glamour and crunchy glitz of Tinseltown, in a rural, woody section of Evanston, Illinois, John Charles Carter is delivered into the world. 33 years later, in 1956, he will play Moses in DeMille's even more spectacular remake of his biblical masterpiece. By then, John Charles Carter will be known to the world as Charlton Heston. His parents kept a small getaway shack in the woods that John's father, Russell Whitford Carter, had built for them by hand. Russell, who had learned construction from his father, was the second son of John Carter, a poor Yorkshire County coal mine pit boy in the United Kingdom, who came to America in search of freedom and fortune, and landed a job as a lumberjack with the Stevens Logging Company of Roscommon, Michigan, a town named after the county in Ireland. Eventually, having sufficiently depleted the forests of Roscommon, the company moved its outfit farther south. Carter, who had saved every penny he earned, managed to convince the county of Roscommon to sell him half the newly denatured forests for a modest sum, in return for his guarantee to produce taxable revenue from it. John's mother, Lilla Charlton, was born in Chicago, descended from the Scott-English clan Fraser of Inverness, a lineage traceable to William the Conqueror, and whose ancestors came down to America from Canada and settled in Illinois. She came from a very interesting family, according to Holly Heston Rochelle, Charlton Heston's daughter. It was run by a strict Victorian-style matriarch, my grandmother, Lilla's mother, Lady Bird, as she was sometimes called by other kids in the neighborhood, or Josie, or Uncle Joe, which referred to Joseph Stalin. That ought to give you an idea of the kind of person she was. Lilla, a dark-haired, blue-eyed beauty, eventually ran off with the first guy who came along who got her out of her restrictive Victorian household. That was Russell. My dad, Charlton Heston, was their firstborn. He arrived on October 23, 1923. She always called him that, Charlton, not John or John Charles. The only one who ever did it, and the only one he would ever let do it. Or sometimes Tigger. Later on, my mom called Dad Charlie, and she was the only one who could do that. Everyone else, all his life, called him Chuck.